Our feeling was in the part of the story that is about abusing women, that every abuse of women and, you know, other people happens around the world and has happened to women around the world. And almost all of them have been in societies where they happen to women and don't happen to men, or they happen to one class and not another. Because it would be easy to sit around with a bunch of smart people and make up, you know, horrible abuses to commit on another human being. But that's pornography. That isn't television, or that isn't, you know, what we're doing or what we're trying to do.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to our podcast. I'm Daphne.
I'm Wendy.
And I'm Jason.
And this is House Podcastica, the Handmaid's Tale edition. We are thrilled to have with us today the creator, writer, and producer from the Emmy Award-winning television series, The Handmaid's Tale, Mr. Bruce Miller. Hi, Bruce, and welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on the show.
We're so glad that you wanted to come on, and we're just amazingly stoked about this season. It was an incredible season. We decided to start podcasting on it this season. Well, actually, some friends of ours did last season, but we were just amazed throughout the whole thing, and especially that the season took quite a bold new direction from where the show had been going before with June escaping to Canada. I wonder, was that a scary move for you to do something so different like that?
Absolutely. First, thank you very much. It is the biggest of all group efforts. I can't even tell you how many hundreds of people make the show, and especially this season where I was stuck here and they were all up in Canada. So I was stuck in Los Angeles. So it was done remotely by me. So your kind words are appreciated, and I'll spread them around. I think to answer your question, it was, of course, it's scary. I mean, when your show's called The Handmaid's Tale and she's not going to be a handmaid anymore, you know, yeah, it's scary. It's a difficult move to land, basically, you know, to pivot the story and make you still feel like you have stakes, you know, and to still feel like, you know, it was done very well by Yalin Chang, but it's kind of a cool TV trick to take someone who is living in Gilead and their only escape is to dream of being in Toronto, and then put them in Toronto and have their only escape of being dreaming in Gilead. Like, she basically reinvented the show and you didn't notice. And I didn't. I mean, she's so deft at it. So, yes, it was a scary decision to make. But on the other hand, we really do follow June. I follow June. I mean, I don't think about what do I want to see happening. I'm thinking kind of what would happen next. And the story with a lot of the refugees we spoke to, and especially the refugees who had escaped, it wasn't when they tried to escape that they escaped. It was just when they were in close enough proximity where people were, you know, you have to get close to a porous place and then eventually you might flow through. So it everybody's story was kind of, I tried and tried and tried, and then I gave up and I was in a coffee shop and then this guy came in, you know, or I tried and tried and tried and tried and tried. And finally, I broke my leg. And when I was in the hospital, you know, it's like everything I did ended up causing, it's like June got herself out of Gilead. Absolutely. Every decision she made, she dragged her ass all the way to where she got to. But because we didn't know along the way that those decisions were going to add up to that, some of them seem, you know, terrible and some of them seem wonderful. But now if you look back, you need all of them to get to where you are now.
Mm-hmm. And I think it feels like because you switched gears like that, where now she's in Canada and wants to be in Gilead, it feels like there were two key things there that kept the show so gripping. One is that, of course, Hannah's still in Gilead and that's where her heart is. But two, maybe that we sort of, as an audience, want to think, okay, once she gets to Canada, she's going to go back into Luke's loving arms and everything's going to be just fine. But actually, no, we didn't take into consideration that she's a changed person. And that's what happens when you're in these kinds of situations. But I wonder for you, you must have a sense of what viewers think they really want. Like, they always want the characters to be happy and have nice things happen. And as a writer, do you feel tempted to go in that direction, or, and it's hard for you to know you have to make your character suffer kind of to make compelling drama and make it realistic?
Well, I think it's a good thing about TV is that I don't have to give them an end. I think the problem is, the problem was very well stated by my daughter, who's 16, who is kind of, in a lot of ways, the inspiration for that decision this season. She doesn't like romantic comedies or books, rom-com books, where they kiss and then the story's over. She has two much older brothers. She knows the first kiss is just the beginning of shit. And that, so it drives her crazy. It's called the kiss and end. And she's like, what, you want them to get together the whole time and you want to see them together. So I was thinking, you know, like you always think, well, when she gets out of Gilead, it's the end of the show. And I was thinking, well, I want to see what happens after that. And the only reason people live happily ever after in stories is that you get told they live, you don't see that part. So this is just seeing what that looks like. And I like the fact that, you know, in some ways it's a Joan of Arc story if Joan of Arc lives. You know, all of a sudden she does this huge thing and then she's got to like go home to wherever, Riem, wherever she lived in France. You know, she's got to go live her life. But also it's just about the fact that what you wish for, Jason, I don't think is what you said. I don't think they wish for the characters to be happy. I think they want what they want. They say, I want her to get out of Gilead. Well, she's out of Gilead. I want her to do this and that. Because, you know, I just think her life is much more fluid than static. And the idea of I'm going to be happy, I'm going to be sad, I'm going to be redeemed, I'm going to be a good person, I'm going to be a bad person, none of those things really apply. And so when you think Lizzie has developed such an unbelievably dynamic character, that when you put her in Toronto, it's the same thing. In Gilead, 90% of her natural moods would get her killed. And 10% are really good at keeping her alive. And in Canada, 90% of the things that she does are really good at keeping her alive. And 10% will get her killed. But it's, you know, it's no different than it was before. You know, and 10% of the things that she's going to do were always part of her. But they've been sharpened, unleashed, and valorized.
So you just need to stay true to that character that you know so well. And the story kind of flows from that, huh?
Yeah. And also, honestly, just thinking about what would happen next, not what would happen on TV, but what would really happen next. The June story as a refugee and her emotional story and Luke's story as the partner of a refugee, those are all taken from research. I mean, those are stories we've heard people tell us. So although they seem weird and in some ways kind of bizarrely unpredictable, they were bizarrely unpredictable to us. But, you know, what June deciding not to go to therapy was a huge thing that we heard that people, because it's not, you know, when people go to therapy, they're trying to figure out what their problem is. She knows what her problem is. She didn't need to talk about it. She didn't need to discover anything. So much of our system is based on the fact that you're hiding something and just by revealing it, you'll be healed. Well, you're not. And she isn't. And this isn't a show about her secret. We know her secret. We have the same problem she does. How the fuck do you get over it?
Yeah, I feel like she's unleashed a lot. In leaving Gilead, she went to Canada and she's unleashed all of this hard work to get there. And then, boom, you can't just turn it off like that. You can't just go into a safe zone and say, oh, now I'm happy, everything's fine. No, not when all of this is still there.
I think also when all of that was life or death.
Yeah.
It's the stakes that really get it. You have to be at 11 all the time in terms of, you know, parsing everybody's looks and what they're doing and who's on whose side. You have to be like that all the time, that when you get to Toronto, you can't turn that off because 100% of her psychic energy is taken up by coping. So she doesn't have any time to adapt who she's doing or to look at she was keeping herself alive and she's at 11 all the time. And she still is. And everything she keeps thinking, when I do this, everything's going to be wonderful. When I kill Fred, everything's going to be wonderful. You know, that's just not the way things work. Mm-hmm.
I would be remiss if I didn't thank you for an incredible show, especially this past season. We opened up this interview to our listeners and asked them what they wanted to ask you. And mostly what they wanted to say was thank you.
Who the hell do I think I am? Yeah, they're very welcome. I'm stealing their money. I really like doing this. Today was actually my first we had a writer's meeting today, this morning, and it was really, it's always surprising that I still get up in the morning excited when it's like, I know it's going to be a day where we're all going to get together. So believe me, it's as fun as you I mean, as hard as the show is, it's equal amounts of fun to make.
And one question that one of our readers, Amelie Rochette, wanted to know and mirrored the same question that I wanted to know was, what is the extent of Margaret Atwood's involvement in the show?
Well, Margaret is as involved as she has time for. I realize that this is Margaret's sandbox and we're playing it, and this is Margaret's world. And I don't defer to her out of some fealty to Margaret Atwood, but because she's such, you know, she built a really solid story, as you can tell, I built it on her story. So all our conversations are very much me trying to kind of have her comment on things where she's very excited to say, don't tell me what happens. I just, you know, it's, she has the experience of kind of going through dramatic things with her characters. So at this point, she, how involved she is at the very beginning, we spoke a bit, but mostly I was scared of her because, you know, she had to read my script, you know, the pilot script. And I don't know how that feels to you, but sending Margaret Atwood your copy of your version of The Handmaid's Tale is not a recipe for success in my mind. So, you know, but we did get to know each other slowly, and I'm very proud to say she's my friend. She's a wonderful, and it's been a long journey, and, you know, COVID, and she lost her partner and everything else. But the first season we didn't talk that much. I kind of, because I was following the book, I didn't have that many questions. So most of what we talked about were kind of general vibe things about Gilead and kind of, you know, how it would look in a beautiful way, because it's so, how would they want it to look? Well, you know, it's a proctored environment. How would they proctor it? You know, it's not natural. They cut all the trees. They want it to look a certain way. So what do they want it to look like? And we talked about the Puritans, and when I had written something about Salem. So, but we've fallen into kind of a rhythm of usually we sit down at some point towards the end of the season. She gets all the scripts and the outlines, and she gets all the cuts to watch if she wants to. And we start talking about the next season. So I've started to kind of noodle with her about what I was thinking about for the next season. And she talks, and she says, you know, she kind of chimes in, but mostly she's, there's been once in a blue moon where she's either called me and said, don't kill Aunt Lydia or name the kid Nicole, you know, because things that she had already decided for the testament. Mm. And then there were some things where she called and said, don't do this and don't do that, which I'm not going to tell you about. it's like those four times are the four times. So now we meet at the end of the season. Then at the beginning of the season, once the story kind of starts to come together, she usually comes to the writer's room. We all talk, and she treats everybody like a fellow writer. It's the most lovely experience, you know, and they all start crying after she leaves, but they usually hold it together while she's there, which is mature and professional of them. Then I try to kind of touch base with her throughout the season, as I rewrite scripts, as I have questions, all sorts of stuff, but she's busier than the four of us combined. I mean, it's amazing how much stuff she does. Even during COVID, she was very, very busy. So I think that one of the things I keep doing is revisiting the book, because I want it to sound like Margaret Atwood wrote the scripts, and I wanted it to sound, feel like she put the stories together. So I think that in some ways, to make up for the fact that I can't live inside her head, I keep living in that part of her head. Literally this morning I was listening to the audiobook of it while I was just brushing my teeth. So
Claire Danes.
Claire Danes, actually, because I think Lizzie does a version, but I think that'd be too weird for me. I haven't listened to it. She said it was weird to do. So I find that she is a huge part of kind of how I do it. I mean, I feel like she's been a partner on the project since the very beginning, since she said my script was okay. Before that, she was a complete just object of terror, remote object of terror.
I mean, you knocked it out of the park, so I hope you're proud. And we don't say that about every show we cover, just know that.
Well, if you've met writers before, I completely disagree, but thank you.
You mentioned the environments are so proctored in Gilead, and it just reminded me, just I'm so in love with the visual language of the show and how it's such a big part of the show, and even the pacing I feel like fits into that. It's all regimented but beautiful, and I wondered how much of that developed as you went along and how much of it you had in your head when you came to the show. I know you have probably great cinematographers and everything, but
Oh yeah, spectacular. And because I think I am very much kind of the overarching, like, give the thematic ethos to the whole group and then let each department figure out how that works in the editing department, the sound department, because I don't know how those things work, you know? So, you know, I know a lot of showrunners, and I used to be one of them, who you go into the editing room and you really want to know the editing thing and say, please, okay, turn that, speed that up and cut two frames and everything. And it's much better to go in there and say, that's not funny. Could you make it funny? Mm. Because that's what they know how to do. Mm-hmm. So my overall ethos was very much that, you know, what would really happen? What would it really look like? And then shoot it in a pretty way, but don't build it so that it doesn't look real. Make it real. And then let's, you know, use the camera to shoot it in a pretty way. And the other thing was, the show's from June's point of view, and always keep that in mind, that it's from June's point of view. And that makes a lot of, strangely, the biggest thing it made the first season is decisions about camera height during handheld stuff. She's petite. Lizzie is about 5'3". And so luckily, Reed Morano, who directed the pilot, was both, she's a director of photography as well as a director, and she liked to operate the camera, and she's about 5'2". So in the crowd scenes where you're kind of doing this, it's a huge difference. The visual language of here or here is a female-male difference. and it really changes things. And because, you know, Lizzie and Samira, they're small, they're petite women. And it's different to go through the world like that. But at the beginning, I tried to kind of just overall give them a good kind of storytelling piece, which is what would really happen, what would it really look like, and then honestly hire people who were really good at it. Mm-hmm. So it was Reed Morano and also Anne Crabtree, who did the costumes the first year. These astonishing costumes. She was, you know, brilliant and really. You know, the Handmaid's outfits are built so that they have a panel on the front, so you can be pregnant in them. They don't have to change. That's how well built. And she built there's a version that she built. You can breastfeed it. I mean, it's like unbelievable how deep the stuff goes about what she
thoughtful.
Yeah, it's so thoughtful. And then Julie Berghoff, who was the production designer in the first year, so she took all of that. What does the house look like? And brought all that to life, and was working, you know, when you do a pilot, you build a lot of sets. So it's millions and millions of dollars, your biggest expense. And you're doing it in a time frame that's impossible, because basically you're building all the sets for the entire season for the first episode. So you have to have everything done. So there are more than one scene in the pilot where we're shooting in this direction and this direction isn't finished. Or like in a kitchen, and we can only shoot from here to here because they're painting that wall literally while we're doing, and then we turn around in 4 hours and shoot that one. So we were that pressed up against it, but I think they all went to the, okay, well, let's think about what part of the story are we going to tell through the way it looks? Okay. You know, what is Gilead trying to say with all this stuff? What's the decision behind it? Why? So that goes all the way down to the, you know, I didn't think of myself as someone who would be as connected to the excruciating minutiae of the show, but I am. I mean, all the dog barks in Gilead are German shepherds.
Because they're utilitarian?
Well, yes, because they come from, they have guard dogs.
Yeah.
And they're really not supposed to have pets, but when you have guard dogs, you have old guard dogs and this and that. So they end up having pets. But, you know, the sirens but also there are many, many more native birds in Gilead because they've done a lot of work to bring those populations up, and not so much in Toronto. Toronto has a lot more interloper birds. So that's just kind of the crazy level you go to. But my feeling is that it just builds a nice bed so that you really feel the story all the way down. And the only way to do it is to not be making those decisions myself, but empower those departments to make the decisions. So, you know, we have a sound guy, and the level of fuss that he has over, you know, the voiceover is treated. I don't know if you've guys read the book, but in the book, it's a recording, a cassette recording that we're listening to. So if you go back and watch the pilot at the beginning of the first time she does a voiceover, you can hear it record. click at the beginning. And so these guys are so detail oriented, and you just empower them to make sure those details get into their work, that they don't say, oh, this would be cool, but Bruce didn't say do it. You're like, this would be cool, Bruce will like it. That's what you want to do.
That's good advice for any boss, everything you just said.
Yeah, agreed. I think it really pays off. Yeah.
It does pay off in the viewer experience, which I think is good. It doesn't just pay off in the television appreciation space, but, you know, like what we're doing now, Yes. You know, television appreciation. But it pays off in the experience of watching it, that Absolutely. If there's never kind of a rough note, when something happens, you so believe that it's real that you don't just feel it here like, oh, my God, mm-hmm. you know, that character just died. But you forget it's a character if every other puzzle piece, yeah. you know, if June's wearing a coat that's the right coat for that weather, that she's wearing a heavy coat because it's freezing, you know.
I mean, one of the things that really stands out to me is the use of light and how often there will be a shaft of light and then darkness around it. And I wonder if there's like a thematic thing with that, or it's very pretty.
There's no direct thematic, like overall, it always means this. There's no like code book,
yeah.
but all of those things are meant to mean something and make you feel something. It's usually the cinematographers we've had on the show, we keep losing them, but going on to huge other projects.
Mm. They get hired away.
God damn their success. We have Stuart Biddlecombe is our DP now, who's just astonishing. And I think that he uses the tools, the similar tools, but in different ways. So, for example, you know, light in our show often is light, but the character is in darkness. The character is dark. Mm. So it's like just the outline and the shape of June. So the outline and shape of June isn't June. It's a handmaid. So he can turn her from June into a handmaid just with light. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of that, but I think he uses it differently in every different space. I just like that it's mindful. You know, I try to do everything on purpose. So if there's something you don't like in the show, it's almost always a decision I made, like really thought about it and, you know, really messed up on purpose, you know, like, you know, don't think I did. Yeah. There's no accidents. There's just bad decisions.
Something that you said earlier about interviewing refugees when you were talking about June going into Canada and leaving Gilead, Margaret Atwood, when she wrote the book, was focused on taking parts and pieces of things throughout history and kind of incorporating it in some way into her story when she created the book and Gilead. Did you feel any pressure to continue that, or was that something that just kind of grew organically?
Well, we did in a sense. I mean, I think that our feeling was in the part of the story that is about abusing women, that everything that happens to every abuse of women and other people happens around the world and has happened to women around the world. And almost all of them have been in societies where they happen to women and don't happen to men, or they happen to one class and not another. Because if it would be easy to sit around with a bunch of smart people and make up, you know, horrible abuses to commit on another human being, but that's pornography. That isn't television, or that isn't, you know, what we're doing or what we're trying to do. So I think that, you know, that's the bad part. It's just different to see it happen, honestly, to an American, to a blonde haired, blue eyed woman. It's very, very different. But these things happen every single day, every single minute. It was very interesting in the season that I read some comments about people were worried that June hadn't gone to therapy. That was my fault. There was a line that said she had gone and hated it, but I cut that out. But I just love the idea that everybody thinks, you know, refugees get therapy. I mean, the way we treat refugees, they expect, you know, Elizabeth Moss to be given therapy. We don't give anybody therapy. We don't give anybody anything. No. We barely let them in at that. So it's just interesting that people, you know, there's this expectation because she's an American and she looks a certain way that they're going to treat her a certain way. And I'm not treating her better, certainly, or worse than anybody else is treating the world. I think she gets a lot of advantages because she is an American and it's a world that takes that into account. She's a white woman and takes that into account. But It just, it strikes me as strange that that people have a complete misunderstanding of you know, that we're not even, we're not, if we showed the things that actually happened in the world, we could never show them. So we are
They're such a tame version.
I mean, when I was doing research on what would happen to June in episode three, when she is imprisoned, you know, I'm not going to show her get raped by trained dogs on television. I'm not going to show that. That's hard, beyond horrific, but that's what happens in the world. So what we did in the show was awful, you know, and, but it doesn't even come close to what's happening, what happens in the world daily. So I think that we certainly don't want to be making stuff up. I think most of the time that we're softening things. Wow. You know, they pushed two Marthas off the roof. They were throwing gay men off the roof in Chechnya, you know, a few years ago. I mean, it's not, none of the, I mean, we don't make up any of this stuff.
I mean, I feel like this is such an important show and it's an important book because, for one thing, it can wake us up to oppressive forces. And I wonder how cognizant you are of it as a vehicle for that, and how much of it are you like, no, it's a TV show following a character, you know? I mean, does it have to be one or the other?
Well, for me, it just has to be a TV show following a character, and I have to be living in that world, because what I don't want to do is tell that. I don't want to tell you how to feel about it. I want to make you feel stuff, and I want things to be complicated. But if I know how I'm going to make you feel, I'm doing you a disservice, because I'm being a simpleton. Yes, I can make you feel scared, but I can't make you feel scared the way you felt when you were 12, when your mother left you alone. You can do that. So if I could just push. So what I want you to do is have your flashbacks. Own experience. Yeah. See, I don't want to tell you what to do. Yeah. I want you to have your, a personal experience will be much.
Mm-hmm. Do you love it, especially when we don't know quite how to feel about?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Because that's the thing that makes me, I love when you kind of fall back on you and everybody else talking about it, like the TV things, like these characters would do this, or this thing would happen to this character, or they did this because of this plot, this, you know, it's like, well, they did this because they couldn't get this character, or this person signed a contract, da, da, da. And a lot of it is just to get out of feeling like June raped Luke. Okay. You know, that's what happened in their marriage. That's what happened that day. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's feel and talk about it. It's a lot easier to think, oh, well, on TV, they would never do that. Well, okay. You know, there are other channels and you can watch those.
You tweeted out some really nice things about the podcast. Thank you so much. We were all stoked to see that. And
I am a fan and a listener, and your commentary has been great.
Thank you so much. It's been
great this year. Yeah. And I think it's nice to have people come in later. And because you guys had such a different experience of watching it and stuff.
Yeah. So, I binged like the first couple of seasons.
Which... I can't even imagine how you're still alive.
But I wanted to ask if you, you know, there must be times when however much you've listened to us and you're just shaking your head going, come on guys, you're way off. Like, does anything stand out that you disagreed with? You can say anything you want.
Oh, no, I would, but I have a terrible memory. But no, I do sit. And most of the time, though, I do feel like you guys go down the primrose path, but I'm the one who lets you. You know, that because I do listen primarily to hear what you guys took away versus what I was trying to do, because I want you to take away something different. But if you're going to take away something different, I have to know what it is, or the scene that I thought was sweet and you thought was awful, next season when they talk about it being sweet, you're going to go, that wasn't sweet. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I have to know how it fell out of the TV.
What the impact
your
was. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. And so in some ways I have a very prosaic way of looking at the show, which is, you know, it's entertainment. It's a thriller. I like all those things. It has to be compelling. It has to move quickly. It has to be funny. It has, you know, and then once you kind of get past all those things, you have to make the best television show you've ever seen. That's what I'm trying to do, is just say, okay, how can I make the TV show that is better than anything I've ever seen? But the other part of it is very kind of the normal conversations you have. And a lot of it, honestly, is that you guys just don't believe me. anymore. So she gets on a boat to go to Canada. And they say, we're going to Canada. We'll be in Canada in 8 hours. We're going to Canada. She's going to Canada. She's out of, she's going to Canada. And you guys go, fuck Bruce Miller. He's never taking her to Canada. I said she's going to Canada 100 times. And then when she steps off the boat in Canada, it's like, oh my God, how did you get to that
she
ending?
She went to Canada.
I'm like, I've been telling you she's been going to Canada since the beginning. But it's just you have such distrust of showrunners in general and too much knowledge of TV shows. You're like, well, conceit-wise, it's like,
yeah,
sorry, you know. She
well, one Canada. Thing that we have said is we love that we can't predict what's going to happen in the show.
Yeah.
So that's so rewarding.
Almost all of it is just that you can absolutely predict, you just don't trust yourself.
Maybe that's what it is.
It's, yeah. It's way too simple. June lives in Gilead. She's a handmaid. If she runs away, she's going to get caught. 100% of the time, she's going to get caught. It's Nazi Germany. They're built to catch her. They're going to catch her. She's a tiny little fish in a big country. She's never going to get away. If she gets away, it's been some huge yeah. circumstance that requires a yeah. ton of stuff. But otherwise, predict, every time she's recaptured, that's what
who would predict
does.
That she was going to take Fred and round up all those women in I the know. Forest? I oh never would have predicted that in a million years. And it was freaking amazing. And all, but also at the same time, I did feel a hurt for just so much revenge, even though he deserved it. You know what I mean? I don't have a question. Well, I like
it makes you feel both ways. You feel like that last scene was so wonderful and awful all at the same yeah. time. Like it makes you feel like, why do I feel so good about this?
Yeah. I really enjoyed the tone in your guys' voices.
Like, oh my that's God,
it,
I love
it's
this.
Exactly. How, yeah, I mean, I was thinking people would be a little more torn, but no, nobody, it's so nobody, hard. Nobody.
We got one message from a listener after our podcast saying, I can't believe you guys all went for that, and no one said you didn't like it. And
I was satisfied.
Oh, well, that's good.
I was satisfied.
That's what I'm looking for is a cathartic experience.
Yeah.
Good or bad.
It was that.
Cathartic experience.
Yeah. I was satisfied with it.
There was one thing that I thought was so interesting, and I wanted to ask you guys a question. There's a moment where Luke says to June, you have to let him go. You have to let this go. You have to let it go. And he was chastised, you know, by some viewers for that, which I understand. You know, I'm just, that's probably what I would say in that situation, right or wrong. That's what I usually do is just say, what stupid thing would I say, you know, to my, you know, but the funny thing was, and I wonder if you guys thought about this, June says the same thing a scene before. I have to let this go. It's so interesting that it's okay coming out of her mouth. And when he says it, it's a complete betrayal.
I didn't think it was a complete betrayal.
Yeah.
I thought it was right. He means if you want to rebuild a life with me, this is what you need to do. I didn't see it as Luke was doing something wrong. It's just that he was so
I
not understanding of where she was at.
Yeah.
That was,
I think there's a huge difference in me, like her, June as a person trying to struggle with her own impulses versus her boyfriend not seeing that struggle's going on and telling her to ignore certain ones. You know what I mean? Like
it
just didn't feel like he was respecting where she was at to me.
I feel like they were both in very different places. Yeah. He'd been in Canada yeah. for so long. And
it was born of a fear of his own that
yeah.
I want her to be with me and be normal like we used to be. So it was kind of it felt selfish too.
A little bit. Yeah. I think that he had lost touch with what it felt like when he arrived from Gilead into Canada. And Emily, for some reason, I felt related to June so much more because what she went through was so much more brutal. At least that was what I was thinking about it. And I think June found some solace in her friendship with Emily because she could relate to it because she had been through it. And no matter how many times you tell Luke, well, this is what happened, he didn't go through it. He didn't feel that persecution. It's hard to feel connected in that way, I think.
But I do understand it. I mean, like you just said, you say, give him the words that you might have said in the same situation. I might have said the same thing too. I don't know.
Oh yeah. That's the thing is that That's the thing, is that one of the things I really try to do is have June and everybody kind of just do their best and not do it perfectly. And, totally. And June is incredibly careful about what she says and the way she phrases things. And so is Serena, such intelligent women that, you know, they don't throw around words willy nilly. So, but you know, you really want it to feel like people are going through the world, like we're going through the world. And if they go through the world perfectly, then I don't think I did a very good job as a writer.
Can you get into all their heads, every character?
Yeah. I mean, it just because it's been trained that way, I think yes. And even the, you know, the very mean interrogator, who interrogated June, you know, the lieutenant, you know, I didn't find that difficult at all either. You know, I kept, you know, because what it was he, you know, he has a job, and if he gets her to talk earlier, he gets to go home. He does this every day. This is his job. There's nothing special about her. He doesn't want to hurt her more than he has to. He doesn't want to hurt her any less than he has to. You know, those, you know, he knew exactly what he was going to do and exactly probably how long it was going to take her to break. He would prefer not to have brought the child there. But I just think it's that was fascinating to me about the more you turned him into kind of the Cleaver's parents, the more interesting he became.
Absolutely.
So yeah.
The guy with the job.
Motherfucker.
So I have to go pretty in a minute, but Wendy, do you want to do a lightning round with their questions? I feel so bad that I don't get to answer the questions of the viewers. If they had anything that they sent to you, I'll answer it.
I've got one.
Yes, please.
Yeah. So one of our listeners, Katie, said she's impressed with Bradley Whitford's portrayal of Joseph Lawrence, but curious, did you intend for the character to have this comic relief role? Or did he just bring that aspect to the character all on his own?
I think it was both. I had Bradley in mind when I wrote the character, but not Bradley kind of, he's got such range that it's kind of just, you can do anything, but I think he definitely brought a vibe of, kind of absent-minded professor with a kind of quirky point of view that is so absurd it seems funny, but I will give all that credit to him. I mean, it's almost everything he says sounds funny. They're so good, all of these people, and I don't know if you've the most lovely bunch. I'm incredibly lucky. All very mature and smart, and you know, I be thrilled to sitting next to any of them on a flight. They're just wonderful people. So I think I, you know, I definitely give that praise to Bradley and his beard. Oh my God. That beard takes him a long way.
Yeah. I think you've answered most of our questions. The only other one was from Diana Driscoll, who hosted this podcast last season. And she said she'd love to know if you're, or the show is planning on incorporating elements from the Testaments, or are they going to keep it separate in future seasons?
Well, since I'm one of they, I get to decide. We have already been laying things in. You know,
with Lydia.
Yeah, Lydia says, you know, basically, I think Lydia has been spending a lot of time pushing down. She's very secure in her position. She's been pushing down on the other ants and the other handmaids, sending all her power down. She's just this season started to realize, I need to pay attention to up. And so to wield that power, she can't just throw around her stick. So to wield that power, she, strangely, just like the eyes, has a woman in every house. She has someone there to spy in every, or lots of commanders' houses. So she, I think, has availed herself of that access to information that Lawrence gives her, and that the handmaids give her. So, you know, now she has a little bit of a nexus. She trusts Lawrence because Lawrence is morally compromised, and she probably trusts Janine enough that if Janine gives her information. So all of those kinds of things. And also, I think she feels like she needs to bolster her spot. And all those things are setting up Lydia for the Testaments. Also, I think the idea of Gilead rising in Toronto or around the world is something we've played little bits of here and there. You know, the Fred and Serena have some acolytes. We had a scene where a bunch of handmaids, you know, women dressed as handmaids in Toronto appear, but we had to cut it due to COVID. Mm. See, that stuff as well from the testament. So I'm not thinking it needs a kind of a clear delineation. I think you want to lay in the groundwork for the things that you see. I really like that in the TV show when I get to see when I remember something from season one and I'm like, oh my God, that actually came around. So a lot of what I do in the off season is watch seasons. I watch old episodes of the show. And a lot of that is because it's hard for me to remember what actually ended up in the show versus what was pitched or what we shot and didn't use. Or, you know, there's lots of times we have something that I consider very real that we don't use. And so you imagine it's already in the show. So it's important that I watch and look at the actors' performances and forget that I kind of help put those performances together and think about, okay, what's June doing, not what's Lizzie doing. So I have a little bit of distance on those because I've kind of forgotten the minutiae of the decisions.
Well, we have reached the end of our time with Bruce. Thank you so much for coming on our podcast and answering our questions, and good luck with constructing the next season of The Handmaid's Tale.
Thank you very much. I'll do my best, I promise.
We're totally going to podcast next season. We'd love to have you back at the end. If you'd be willing to come back another time, that'd be great. But thank you so much.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. This was great.
It was great for me too. And I, the fact that you guys have a guy on the show really helps. It's very interesting for, you know, because I'm a guy and I write the show.
That's what I was going to ask you too, if you were concerned, because I looked around at the other Handmaid's Tale podcast. I don't think there are any other guys. It's all women, and wondering if as a man.
It is. I mean, as I said, you know, whenever I get interviewed by the press or asked, they all ask a different version of who the hell do you think you are? I mean, and I'm on their side. I mean, definitely. When they were looking for a showrunner for this show, they were only looking at women showrunners. And I was like, I'm completely on your side. I hope you find one, but I really want the job. What do I do? So, but I think, you know, on any show, you have to buttress your deficits. And that's one of my deficits. You know, I have lots of other deficits on this show, you know, things I don't know, things I don't, you know, that I have to find people who know. But I think going through the world as a woman is something I just can't fathom. And so that I have to buttress with people that are not only good at explaining, but patient at being questioned after they explain to the dopey guy what it is. But we have found two things, which is, you know, usually, you know, not now, but at the very beginning of my career, often there was only one woman in the room. My room's all women, you know, except for me and Tuckman, you know, it's like, and hilariously, they never agree on anything. So they're used to being the one woman in the room where it's kind of, I'm the woman. I get to say what this feels like or that feels like. Now they've lost. It's hilarious because they never agree on anything. I get no information. And I'm asking, we're asking really weird questions, like perception questions, like what does it feel when a baby latches on? What is it, you know, what do those feel like? Or how, you know, how does... You're asking really specific things when June is deciding to have sex with Nick in Gilead. Why is she deciding to do that? And you never see someone on TV like her. She's a woman who likes sex and actually needs sex and likes, you know, and she has, and you never see that person. So we don't even know how to write that person. So you got to ask real people, you know, the questions. So, and luckily talk to Lizzie, because Lizzie is nice and, collaborative with all that stuff. So anyway, it's a pleasure to talk to you guys. And I'll make sure I have some complaints next time.
Excellent. Thanks again, Bruce.
Okay,
thanks,
take Bruce. Care.
Take care.
Thanks Bye. Again. Bye. Bye.